Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How will history judge Barack Obama's first 100 days as President of the United States? He entered the White House with America mired in two wars and what may be the most serious economic crisis since the Great Depression. And now, with just a single day before the end of that critical 100 days, the country is gripped by growing fears over the outbreak of a deadly and contagious virus. Given both the magnitude of the problems he faces and the initial trust he has inspired in American voters, numerous comparisons have been made between President Obama and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But are those comparisons accurate, and how far is it reasonable to take them? My guest today is here to discuss those questions. H.W. Brands is Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History and Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He has written 22 books, including the Pulitzer Prize finalist and New York Times bestseller The First American, and last year's Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. H.W., welcome to Think.
Delighted to be with you, Chris.
How closely do you think Barack Obama is studying Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Well, I have a personal reason for hoping that he's studying very closely because I sent him a copy of my book. Beyond that, he's certainly aware of the historical parallels. One can't avoid them in the newspapers and on television. Whether he is looking at Roosevelt as a model for his own administration or simply as a reflection of how another administration dealt with a crisis that's similar to the one that he faces, I don't really know.
Where is the limit, do you think, in making reasonable comparisons between the two men and between the conditions in which they've begun their presidencies?
One of the things that a person can take from history, whether a layperson or a public official, is to figure out what has been attempted in the past, what worked, what didn't work, and to ask whether the same conditions or similar conditions apply today. So one of the things that we sometimes run the risk of doing when we don't pay attention to history is we try to reinvent the wheel. And maybe we discovered, in fact, that the wheel wasn't appropriate. We needed something else. So in the case of Obama looking at the example of Franklin Roosevelt, he can see, for example, how Roosevelt made a personal emotional connection with the American people. Probably the greatest accomplishment of Roosevelt during the Great Depression was not the political and economic programs of the New Deal, which did, indeed, alleviate the suffering of the New Deal, but they didn't end the Depression. The greatest contribution that Roosevelt made was to restore the confidence and hope of the American people. The Depression was on for a couple of years before Roosevelt became president, and many Americans despaired that their government cared anything for them or could do anything positive for them. When Roosevelt came into office, he brought in a kind of dynamism that had been lacking under Herbert Hoover, and he gave Americans good reason to believe that now, finally, the government in Washington felt their pain and was willing to do something about it. So he didn't end the Depression, but he did dispel the despair that the Depression had engendered in the American people.
Well, I think we've all heard countless times about the effectiveness of the fireside chats, but those of us too young to have experienced them firsthand might not fully understand what made them so revolutionary. Will you talk about how American listeners might have experienced that first broadcast?
Well, as a matter of fact, it's never too late to get the experience oneself. The fireside chats are all available on the Internet. So I did an experiment. This is called this experimental history. And I knew, for example, that Roosevelt's first fireside chat occurred after a week of his being in office. And it came on late on a Sunday night in the middle of March 1933. And so in much of the country, especially in the North, it was still very cold. And there were a lot of people around the country who were trying to conserve fuel, save money, and one of the ways you do this is on cold nights you go to bed early. So they were already in bed when Roosevelt's voice came over the radio. Now, I did this. I turned out the lights, got under the covers, and I listened using my computer rather than radio to Roosevelt's first fireside chat. And the effect is quite remarkable because it's almost as though your father or a favorite uncle, your grandfather, is telling you a bedtime story. He's tucking you into bed and saying, it's going to be okay. Now, that's not exactly what he said the first time around. What he said was that the banking system is in turmoil. He explained in a 15-minute address, he explained how banking is supposed to work. He explained how the banking system was failing at that moment. He explained what he, his administration, and the Congress had done to to deal with the crisis, he laid out the timetable by which the banks, which had been closed under his executive order for a week, how they were going to start reopening the next day and more the day after that and so on. And then he said to the American people, and one of the aspects of the magic of radio is that a president can address 60 million people, and each person listening has to conjure the image of this president in his or her own mind. It's as though the president is speaking to each person individually. And so he asked each of those people individually, all 60 million of them, to help with the success of this banking program. And he said that without the support of the American people, we can have no success. But with the support of the American people, there's nothing we cannot accomplish together. And the effect of this fireside chat was almost magical. For weeks before this, every time banks appeared, so every time lines appeared outside banks, the bank owners were filled with trepidation because they were sure it meant that all the depositors wanted to get their money out of the banks, and the banks then were in danger of collapsing. The next morning, lines once again formed outside the banks, but this time, the depositors wanted to put their money back in the banks. And the banking crisis, one can almost say in the 15 minutes of that first fireside chat, the banking crisis was resolved. Now, the larger depression still persisted, and Roosevelt and the country had a lot of work to deal with it. But the despair that had gripped the American people all of a sudden lifted, and things looked a whole lot better.
Do you think, H.W., that level of cooperation, of hearing the president say, please, please put your money back in the banks, and people doing it, and that kind of pure trust in a political leader is something that belongs to a bygone era?
I won't say that it won't recur at some point. I don't think Barack Obama should count on it. And the reason is that the Depression in the 1930s was far worse than the situation we're dealing with now. What we've got is a worrisome economic situation. And it's been going on now for a year. The financial system has been tottering. At the moment, it doesn't look like it's going to collapse. We don't know that it won't eventually, but for the moment, that's not the huge concern. The unemployment rate is rising, but it's still not any higher than it was in the early 1980s. In other words, Barack Obama has both an opportunity and a challenge. He's got an opportunity that Roosevelt didn't have. He has a greater challenge than Roosevelt faced. The opportunity is that he can short-circuit this recession before it becomes a full-blown depression. Roosevelt inherited a country really at the bottom of the economic cycle, at the worst bottom of any economic cycle in American history. Obama inherits a situation that is worrisome, but not yet, we hope, disastrous. The challenge is that Obama has to exercise greater care than Roosevelt did. Things were about as bad as they could get when Roosevelt became president. The American people knew it. The American people knew they had almost no choice but to follow Roosevelt's lead and his advice. The American people today are more skeptical because they realize things actually could get worse. Franklin Roosevelt almost could do no wrong because things were so bad. Barack Obama is in a situation where a lot of people think he really can do wrong, and they're telling him that every day.
So if Mr. Obama's 100 days don't match FDR's in terms of achievement or even ambition, is that because we are not in straits as dire as those that existed when FDR took office?
That's one of the reasons, but the imperatives of the media aside, 100 days is an utterly false standard for judging a president.
Yeah.
And not simply because it's arbitrary, but because the conditions, the structural conditions in 1933 were quite different from what they are today. The Congress that Roosevelt dealt with during the 100 days was the Congress in a special emergency session. In fact, Congress wasn't scheduled to meet in a regular session until December. The legislative calendar was quite different in those days. And so there was an urgency on the part of Congress. In fact, it was very much like the Texas state legislature, which is every other year meets in a regular session of defined length. Now, in Roosevelt's case, the special session wasn't of defined length, but everybody knew when they got the job done, they could and would go home. And so there was this desire to get the work done as expeditiously as possible. There was one other thing that made life different in those days. Air conditioning had not yet arrived in Washington, D.C.
So nobody wanted to be there in the summer.
Well, that's exactly it. The 100 Days Congress, and the first thing I should say is that Roosevelt had no idea. No one had any idea that this 100 days would be 100 days. He initially called Congress into special session, thinking he would keep the members there for a week or at most two, get the most important bills passed, then he'd send them home, and they'd come back late in the fall. But because they were so amenable to his suggestions, he figured, well, might as well keep them around. But with each week that passed, the weather in Washington got warmer, and no one wanted to stay in Washington during the hot weather. Not only was it uncomfortable, but it was downright unhealthy. And Roosevelt was a living example of the unhealthiness of life in crowded cities during the summer. Roosevelt had contracted polio in the summer of 1921. So people had a real urgency about getting out of town. Now, with the legislative calendar these days, 100 days is about to end tomorrow. But Congress isn't going anywhere. The Congress these days is in session pretty much full time. And so members of Congress, they're not thinking, okay, if we just get this bill passed, then we can go home. No, they could pass this bill tomorrow, but they'll have to show up for work the next day. So there isn't that sense that time is of the essence. In fact, there's really much more of a kind of wait-and-see attitude at this point, I think, to wait and see if the stimulus package is working.
My guest is H.W. Brands. He is Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History and Professor of Government at UT Austin. We're talking about the comparisons between Obama's first 100 days and FDR's first 100 days. We'll be back to this conversation in just a moment. I have run a little overtime because H.W. Brands is so unbelievably fascinating. So I'm going to ask you to help me make up for this by making your call now to 1-800-456-5372. We are working on this challenge grant, an additional $1,500 to the station from our friends at Fujitsu Network Communications. If and only if we are able to raise a total of $5,000 by the end of this hour, we have $2,560 to go. Your call right now will do two things. Not only will it make us that much closer to achieving the goal, but, you know, there's this kind of strange psychology that when people hear that we're closer and closer, then it motivates them. So we would ask you that if you've considered making a call at all during this drive, please do it now so that we don't leave this huge amount of money, $1,500, sitting on the table. Our number is 1-800-456-5372.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Jeff. And online pledges count as well, right?
Yes, they do. So I went back in my inbox from yesterday.
Oh,
and
this
I got
is the
this,
letter.
Yeah, they got this message from Reverend Rebecca Grogan. Because I asked, you know, let me know why you won't join the station. And we'll see, you know, I'll see if I can do something about it. And Reverend Grogan wrote, "I'm one of those who have listened to NPR off and on over the past few years. This year, I've taken to listening to it in my office during the day. I really rely on it," she writes, "to know what's going on and what's really happening with issues that are of interest to me. This year, last week, in fact, I joined." She says, "It's not that much, but I do believe in public radio. I believe in differing points of view, and public radio gives us just that. As a member of the clergy, it's important for us to give voice to issues that are always a part of public radio. Thank you for the opportunity to put my money where my mouth is."
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to write and, of course, making the pledge, Reverend Grogan.
It's really great. And I mean, you know, and the offer still stands. I'd like to know why you did or why you won't join the station. My email address is jwhittington@kera.org. In the meantime, we're working on this challenge, and we have heard from Jim Powell in Dallas and Brittany Saliano in Fort Worth.
And we'd love to hear from you next. Please take that 2 minutes to call 1-800-456-5372 or go online to kera.org. If you want to become a friend member, that's the $1,500 level. We can boil that down to just $125 a month if you join as a sustaining member, or, of course, you can do this with a credit or debit card as well. 1-800-456-5372 is our number. KERA.org, you can check out thank you gifts.
Yes, and don't forget, there is a challenge on the table. We've got to raise $2,560 more dollars, or we have to say thanks but no thanks to Fujitsu Network Communications for their $1,500 challenge. So please be the next one to call or contribute online.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is bestselling author and Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History and Government at UT Austin, H.W. Brands. We're talking about the first 100 days of Barack Obama as compared with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. If you'd like to join our conversation, we welcome you to call 1-800-933-5372 if you are willing or able to even consider helping us to earn our challenge grant of $1,500 from Fujitsu Network Communications. We ask that you also go online to kera.org or call 1-800-456-5372. H.W., to the extent that President Roosevelt used radio to sort of bypass the mainstream media of his day, which was print journalism, is there a reasonable comparison with President Obama's YouTube releases?
It's hard to know. One of the problems that Barack Obama has is that there are too many media, and there's no one that commands the attention of nearly in the entire population. When Roosevelt gave his fireside chats, all other radio broadcasting was preempted, and the four national radio networks carried his words alone. You couldn't get away from it. Saul Bellow, the author, was a young man in Chicago in the 1930s, and he describes an evening when, as a young man, he wanted to get out. He didn't want to listen to a political talk. And so he started walking across the city of Chicago. It was a warm night, and the windows were open in people's houses and apartments, and the windows were open in their cars, and he discovered that he could walk entirely across the city of Chicago and not miss a syllable of Roosevelt's fireside chat because everybody had it tuned in, and his words came out the windows of the homes, came out the windows of the cars, and so on. These days, there's no medium that commands that kind of attention. Television is the closest, but television is a medium that really is not conducive to the kind of emotional connection that radio allows. With radio, it's almost like reading a novel as compared to watching a film, because with the novel, you have to create the character in your head. With radio, it's the same way. You get the voice, but you don't get the face. You don't get television, for example, gives us too much input. We get distracted by the stuff around the speaker and all the other people in the room. With radio, we can just hear it in our heads. So Obama is trying various media. So he's trying YouTube. He's been on television. He's done town hall meetings. He's been on radio. He's written op-ed pieces. And I think he's trying to figure out which one works best for him. It's not impossible for a president to create that kind of emotional connection with the American people. But I think it's probably harder than it was in the 1930s.
He does seem, and this is just my opinion, to be exceptionally good in the town hall format. Does that distinguish him from his recent predecessors, do you think?
Well, Obama is certainly more facile in that kind of setting than George W. Bush. Bill Clinton was very good at it. And Bill Clinton was, to my eye and ear, as good a speaker in his own way as Barack Obama. Probably better off the cuff, probably better in a close kind of setting where people are all around him. In that respect, Clinton, and to some extent Obama, in the town hall meetings, are like Roosevelt in a particular venue. Roosevelt was a master of radio. He was also a virtuoso of the press conference. Now, press conferences in those days were conferences for members of the newspaper and magazine press. Broadcast journalists, radio journalists, weren't there. And the press conferences were not broadcast. As a result, Roosevelt could go off the record. Roosevelt could speak for background. Roosevelt could communicate with this. It wasn't really a select group. It was all the White House correspondents, sometimes numbering as many as 200. And they jammed into his office, hanging on his every word. He understood how much they depended on him, and he also understood how much they enjoyed his performances. Roosevelt reveled in this kind of setting. And he was absolutely brilliant in bringing the reporters along. That opportunity no longer exists in the same format. Now, it's quite true that a president, if he wanted to, could give an interview to a whole bunch of people at once, and just say, okay, I'm going to set the rules. Some things I'm going to say are going to be off the record, other for background and so on. But it's a lot harder to manage these days. Roosevelt did this twice a week for the 12 years of his presidency. It's really difficult to imagine that a president, President Obama, would do anything like that today.
want to talk about buy-in for Roosevelt's version of the stimulus package. Initially, he had planned something called the National Recovery Administration, but in fact, the Supreme Court didn't allow that. Can you talk about what the court's objection was?
Well, the National Recovery Administration was far more ambitious than anything Barack Obama has envisioned or at least spoken of now. The NRA actually was designed to revamp the operation of the American economy. Large sectors of the economy would be brought into what amounted to cartels, and employers would write rules with labor unions, and these rules would be enforced by the government. Roosevelt adopted this from his experience in Washington during the First World War, where something similar had been done to reorganize the American economy for the war effort. Roosevelt's experiment lasted a little bit less, about 2 years. The Supreme Court overruled it in the spring of 1935. Roosevelt didn't particularly mourn it. By then, he was realizing maybe this wasn't such a good idea. Obama's stimulus package leaves the economy, for the most part, in its current form. Banks a little bit different, but the rest of the economy is just as it is. And what the government is doing is simply injecting money into the economy. The government is going to spend stuff, but it's going to be spending money through private employers.
So how did the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Works Progress Administration compare with President Obama's plan to create green jobs to stimulate recovery?
There's a close parallel there. Roosevelt had this idea of a Civilian Conservation Corps. Again, he was thinking about his experience and the experience of the country during the First World War, when young men went off and joined the Army. And they found that this was a very important formative experience for them, besides providing them what amounted to a job, yes, and a paycheck. So Roosevelt thought, let's recapture that experience during the Depression. One of the things that Roosevelt was very concerned about was that young people who were getting out of school and would ordinarily have entered the workforce not find jobs. And if they didn't find jobs, then Roosevelt feared that they would never develop the habit of working for a paycheck. So it was exceedingly important to him to make sure that these young men get jobs and that they connect honest work with a paycheck. Now, the kind of work that he particularly favored was work on the nation's public domain. There were forests that needed replanting. There were forest fires that needed combating. There were trails and roads in the national forest and on public lands that needed improvement. There were all sorts of additions and improvements to the public domain. We would call a lot of this infrastructure that could be done, that wasn't being done, because nobody was paying for it at that time. And Roosevelt decided we can kill a couple of birds with one stone here. We can put these young people to work, and we can build up the nation's infrastructure.
It seems that that would also have cultivated a sort of visceral patriotism among people who took these jobs, because they could point to things that they had physically worked on and say, this is what I've done for my country.
That was very much the case. And people who helped build, for example, well, there were other programs besides the Civilian Conservation Corps. The WPA, the Works Progress Administration, was the best example. But it was on a similar model. And so some of the great public structures in America were built by the WPA and the CCC. Timberline Lodge in Oregon. I happened to grow up in Oregon. I used to spend winter weekends at Timberline Lodge. And everybody pointed to this as something that never would have been built if not for the federal works programs during the Great Depression. And it's something that's still with us today. These are some of the proudest monuments to American public action. And that the scope exists to do similar things today. You know, maybe we have a hard time thinking, okay, what would we do that would be comparable to that? Well, before Timberline Lodge was built, no one had any idea what they would build. It requires some imagination. It requires a belief that government can really do important, good things, and now is the opportunity to do it.
What was the interplay of ideas between FDR and the British economist John Maynard Keynes?
Keynes was somewhat of, well, at the time he was an unorthodox economist who had this idea that industrial depressions occurred when private demand and private consumption fell short. And he said that the way a government can remedy this is to increase public demand. When private citizens don't spend enough, and therefore when workers fall into unemployment and factories fall silent, then somebody has to restart the engines of the economy, and that somebody can be the institutions of government. His ideas were new. They were unorthodox. Until then, the general belief was that in a downturn, the government needed to tighten its belt, just as everyone else tightened their belts. Keynes said, no, when other people are tightening their belts, the government needs to loosen its belt, and that will maintain employment, that will maintain the output at a fairly steady rate. It's worth adding that Keynes also said that when the economy is booming, then the government should tighten its belt so that on average, the government should, so its government revenues and expenditures should equal out. Keynes published his magnum opus on the subject, The General Theory, in 1936, but he had communicated with Roosevelt personally. He'd written him a couple of letters, and he visited Washington to put forward this idea and urge Roosevelt to undertake deliberate deficit spending. Roosevelt never really accepted the idea of the ideas of Keynes as economic theory. Roosevelt was not a theorist. He did run some deficits, but these weren't deliberate deficits in the lines of what Keynes had in mind. These were deficits that simply resulted from programs that Roosevelt thought was necessary. The upshot of all of this is that not until the Second World War did Roosevelt become an operating Keynesian. And even then, it wasn't because he deliberately adopted Keynes's view. It was because he thought the country needed to spend the money on winning the war. But World War II was, among other things, an exercise in large-scale Keynesianism. And to that extent, it proved Keynes's theories right, because the spending on the war did indeed revive the American economy.
H.W. Brands is my guest. He's Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History and Professor of Government at UT Austin. We're talking about comparisons between the first 100 days of Barack Obama and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We'll resume our conversation with H.W. Brands in just a moment. Right now, we want to update you on the challenge grant that we have going. We've been offered $1,500 by the Fujitsu Network Communications Group if we can raise $5,000 in the 2 hours today of Think. We are more than halfway there. I'm delighted to see this. We have $2,220 to go, but just about 24 minutes to get that done. So now is the perfect time. If you've been waiting for the drama is making us crazy here. We would love to be able to get this. We would hate to leave all this extra money behind. Please give us a call now and help us to earn that challenge grant. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number, or you can go to kera.org online. Senior producer Jeff Whittington is here with me in the studio now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to say thanks to Ruth Gluck in Dallas for her participation. Nancy Litauer in Dallas renewed her membership. We heard from Carrie Peek in Mansfield and James Heineman in Denton. They've done their part. How about you? 800-456-5372. Online at kera.org. Remember, we have to raise $5,000 total by 2 o'clock. I know we can do this with your contribution right now at 800-456-5372. It's a $1,500 at-risk challenge from Fujitsu Network Communications. And as I said earlier during the show, if you've been waiting for an opportunity to really make a difference during the Think program the past week and a half, maybe this is a time to give a little bit more if you've been considering giving at a higher level. We've heard from some folks at the $240 level during the show today. We've heard from some folks at the $365 level. If that's right for you, then it would really help us chip away at this remaining $2,200 and change to make this challenge.
We have already met two challenges today that have helped the drive, and we are very thankful to those of you who joined during those challenges. This is a totally separate one, though, and this is tied to a different goal, this $5,000 during the 2 hours of Think. We have about 23 minutes left to go. We ask that you call now, 1-800-456-5372, or go to kera.org. Little update on what we have left, Jeff.
$2,100 left to raise to make the challenge, to make the $5,000 goal, and to be able to accept the Fujitsu Network Communications additional gift of $1,500 to KERA. This extra $1,500 will go a long way here at the station to help pay the bills, and your contribution right now at any level, but especially at a little bit higher level, maybe $200 or $300 in support of KERA, in support of the show, will really help us make this challenge. Again, just $2,100 left to raise, and we can do it if you'll call right now, 800-456-5372, or contribute online at kera.org.
We are delighted to be able to say thanks to folks including Ellen Johnson in Plano, who made an additional gift. Thank you so much. Anupama Prakash in Flower Mound renewing a membership. Thank you very much there. Thank you to you if you are picking up the phone right now. We really, really would love to get this additional $1,500. And now that we have, you know, $2,100 left to go, if you're about to make a call, consider that your money is extended by this challenge by almost by 100%. You know, if you're one of these last $1,500 that comes in, whatever amount you can give is great. But if you are able to give a significant amount and you've been sort of waiting for the right time in the drive, this would be ideal because this one is not tied to the number of calls. It's tied to the dollars that we raise. 1-800-456-5372 is our number.
Yeah, if you and as Chris said yesterday, if you are going to contribute anyway before the drive is over, then why not do it now? Why not call 800-456-5372? Why not go online to kera.org and make your pledge now? Because once we get your contribution and everyone else who's going to contribute before we end the drive will end and we can get back to the regular schedule. And that's what we really want to do as quickly as possible this week. So please don't wait any longer. Please call 800-456-5372. Remember, there's a challenge, a $1,500 at-risk challenge in play during the show today from Fujitsu Network Communications to help move the drive along to a speedy conclusion. We've got to raise $5,000 total, or we have to say no thanks, and we can't accept the $1,500. And there's just $2,100 left to raise, $2,100 left to go. Please call now.
If you are in a position to make a $600 contribution to KERA on a credit or debit card, we can offer you an Andrea Bocelli tickets at the American Airlines Center for Saturday, June 13th at 8. I am told that these are exceptionally good seats. They're in, 117 and 114. Those are the sections. Again, we will send you a pair with our compliments when you join right now with a credit or debit card at the $600 level. Join at any level and you will have our undying gratitude. Please give us a call at 1-800-456-5372 or go online and make a contribution at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is H.W. Brands. He is Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History and Professor of Government at UT Austin. He is the author of 22 books, including last year's Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We're talking to him this afternoon about the comparisons between the first 100 days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Barack Obama. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. H.W., do you think that FDR's greatest economic achievement was leading the country out of the Depression, or was it creating a structure that helped prevent a Depression from happening again to the same extent?
I think it's definitely the latter. Roosevelt really couldn't claim credit for ending the Depression with his New Deal. As I mentioned before the break, what ended the Depression in the United States was the spending on the Second World War. But what Roosevelt also did with the New Deal was to put measures in place that ensured that, at least until now, the nation would not suffer another Depression. And in fact, when people today talk about even the worst-case scenarios, the unemployment rate might rise to 10, 12%. And that's bad by historical standards, but by comparison to the Great Depression, when the unemployment rate was 25%, it's, well, only half as bad. And one of the reasons that these prognosticators are so confident, I think rightfully so, that things aren't going to get as bad as they did during the 1930s is precisely because of the checks, regulations, the countercyclical spending programs that were put in place during the Great Depression. A couple deserve mention. One is Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The banking crisis today, such as it is, has been a crisis for bank shareholders, but it hasn't been a crisis for bank depositors. I don't worry, you don't worry, that you're the bank that has your savings account or your checking account in it is going to fold up, because we know that even if it does, we'll get our money back. The FDIC will guarantee our deposits. And for that reason, we don't put the pressure on the banks that caused them to fold during the 1930s. A second example, one that's probably dearer even to the hearts of millions and millions of Americans now, is Social Security. Roosevelt believed that a country as wealthy as the United States had an obligation to ensure a kind of social security. People had talked about national security and military security. Well, Roosevelt thought in terms of a social security. And it was a security, it was a safety net that would help people when bad things happened to them through no fault of their own. This included unemployment insurance. There was no federal unemployment insurance program before Social Security came along. And of course, the centerpiece in the minds of most people today, old age pensions. There were no general old age pensions before Roosevelt came along. And the Depression was especially devastating to old people who had saved up their whole lives and who, some of them, put their money in stocks and were wiped out in the Great Crash of 29. The more conservative put their money in banks, believing that, okay, now I've saved and saved and saved, and when it comes time for me to retire, then I'll be able to draw the money out over time. But then the banks folded, and they lost all of their life savings. So Roosevelt thought that this was a national disgrace, and it was something that the United States could afford to preclude happening again. This was the essence of Social Security. And Social Security is also one of the major reasons that the current recession is not going to become a full-blown depression, because Social Security provides old people a continuous stream of income, and it will continue to be spent. And there's the counter-cyclical part of the unemployment insurance. When people lose their jobs and they no longer have the private income, then they get some public income from Social Security. So FDIC, Social Security, and one could mention various other kinds of programs, reforms, regulations, some of which actually were weakened during the 1990s, being one of the contributors to the financial crisis of the last year and a half.
So did the willingness of the American people, and conservatives in particular, to embrace these, what were at the time quite radical concepts, do you see a parallel here in the health care crisis and the efforts of the Obama administration to guarantee some kind of, if not nationalized, at least universal access to health care?
I assume that if and when President Obama unveils his health care reform package, he will cite Franklin Roosevelt, and he will probably mention that Roosevelt initially intended that Social Security would include health insurance, just like unemployment insurance. But he decided that was a little bit more of a battle than he was willing to take on at the time. But he assumed that his successor, or perhaps the president after that, would be able to complete this project. I think Franklin Roosevelt would be very surprised that here, 70 years later, we still haven't completed that part of his Social Security program. Now, whether this is going to be something that Obama is going to present in the same way that Roosevelt did, in terms of this is a way of insuring Americans against the vicissitudes of life, I don't know. You mentioned at the beginning of the question about how conservatives rallied behind Roosevelt. In fact, it's easy for us to think that Roosevelt was wildly popular. Roosevelt was popular by the standards of American politics. In American politics, it is exceedingly rare for a president to get as much as 60% of the vote. If a president gets 60%, that is a huge landslide. But what that means, of course, is that 4 voters out of 10 are not voting for him. The title of my book is Traitor to His Class. And the people who called Roosevelt a traitor to his class really meant those words seriously. They believed that Roosevelt was selling out the interests of the wealthy, of the responsible, of the respectable in America. Roosevelt had enemies, political enemies, that were at least as bitter as the enemies of Barack Obama. Actually, Barack Obama is being handled very gently by the standards of the 1930s. And there were people who called Roosevelt a socialist, called him a communist, who believed that he was leading the country to hell in a handbasket. Roosevelt responded by lashing back at them. And the politics of the 1930s was as bare-knuckled as politics has been or was in the 20th century. Roosevelt was called a socialist, a communist by his critics. Roosevelt turned around and called his critics economic royalists, people who had only their narrow interests at heart. We haven't yet come to that in American politics today. I don't know if we will. Politics today, and many of your listeners may be surprised to hear this, is quite genteel by historical American standards.
Let's take a call now from Richard in Lake Dallas. Hello, Richard.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
I was wondering if the guest might explain the economic reasoning behind Roosevelt's gold confiscation of 1933 and explain what that is and, you know, why it happened.
Sure.
And I'll take my I'll take the answer up here.
Thanks.
Okay. In 1933, the United States was still on the gold standard. And what this meant was that the American money supply was limited by how much gold the United States had in its possession. Other countries had been on the gold standard, but many of them had been forced off the gold standard. Britain was the pioneer of the international gold standard in the 19th century, was forced off the gold standard during the First World War, tried to come back on the gold standard in the 1920s, but couldn't make it stick. As long as the American economy was on the gold standard, the ability of the president or the chairman of the Federal Reserve or the Board of Governors of the Fed or anybody else to manage the money supply was dramatically limited. One of the problems that Roosevelt recognized, and economists and the Fed governors did as well, that the country faced during the Great Depression was a dramatically falling price level. And the falling prices were wreaking havoc on the lives of farmers, for example, and other people who owed debts. If you're a debtor, deflation, which was the phenomenon that set in, is a serious problem because you have to pay back, in effect, more valuable dollars than you borrowed, which means you have to work harder to earn those dollars. Roosevelt believed that one answer to America's economic problems was to get prices to go back up again. And in fact, economists since then have realized that deflation is a serious problem for any advanced economy. And Ben Bernanke and the Fed today are trying to do everything they can to avoid deflation. Well, in Roosevelt's day, the way to avoid deflation was to sever the link between gold and the dollar. And so what Roosevelt did was to take gold out of ordinary circulation and basically tell Americans that the dollars were no longer backed by gold. This was when the United States government first began seriously managing the American money supply. And it's been the standard in all countries, essentially, since that time.
In the very few seconds we have left, would you say that the most important lessons from FDR to Obama are political as opposed to economic?
I would actually say that the most important lessons are psychological. And you can read that into politics. But a president, whether it's Roosevelt or Obama, who can address the fears and concerns of the American people and can make the American people believe that tomorrow is going to be better than today, is a president who has made a very large step toward getting at the root of the economic problems we face.
The 22 books by H.W. Brands include last year's Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, H.W.
I enjoy it, Chris. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks to all of you who are calling and hopefully making this challenge grant possible that we have from Fujitsu Network Communications. We need to raise $5,000 by the end of the hour. That gives us about 6 minutes right now. We have left to go about $1,200, which is great. That means, you know, $1,020 contributions in the next few minutes will put us there. We have $985 left to raise in order to get this additional $1,500 from Fujitsu. We would so appreciate it if you would be among those who help make this possible. Give us a call now, please, at 1-800-456-5372 or go online in the next couple of minutes to kera.org and make your pledge there.
Thanks to Vincent Carpenter in Dallas for renewing his membership. Scott Johnson in Rockwall gave an additional gift. Thanks so much, Scott. We also heard from Grace Breeze in Fort Worth and Lorene McClellan in Cedar Hill. 800-456-5372 is the number to call, online at kera.org. It's really crucial that you do it right now. If you can afford to contribute a little bit more, maybe $240 or $365, it'll help us knock this challenge out and proceed on closer and closer and closer to the end of this membership campaign. Again, Fujitsu Network Communications has placed $1,500 at risk, and they've said, you know, you've got to raise $5,000 during the Think program today, and we have just over 5 minutes left to go. So please don't wait. Please call 800-456-5372.
A single Friends member right now would bring us over the top and allow us to get this extra $1,500. The truth is, we don't care how it happens. We don't care if it happens with, you know, 10 people at $100 or one person at $1,000 or $1,500. The important thing is, though, that it happens by the end of Think today. 1-800-456-5372 is our number, or you can do this at kera.org. That counts as well. We do have everybody who joins or makes an additional gift or renews a membership during this campaign is signed up for this drawing for a trip to London on British Airways. You get a $1,000 Marriott gift card and a tour of the BBC studios. That's pretty exciting for whoever wins that.
Yeah, and the tickets are business class tickets as well. So it's a pretty great getaway. Someone will win this. Maybe you, if you call 800-456-5372. Please call now. Please help us meet this remaining $925 that we have to raise in order to receive the additional $1,500 for the station from Fujitsu Network Communications. We want to thank them for their generosity in making this challenge, but we'd love to thank you for following the lead of Jack Chapman in Plano. Thank you, Jack. Also, Deborah Forrest in Dallas.
Making an additional gift, and Nasser Husseini in McKinney, also an additional gift. Bill Matthews in Dallas renewing a membership. Thanks to all of you. We have $925 left to go. Just about 3 minutes. We definitely have enough staffers there to take your call, so don't worry about that. We will make sure that if you have picked up the phone to call between now and the end of the hour, we will make sure that your contribution counts toward this. $1,500 is on the table here. You have the power to make it happen. You will be supporting your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1 Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and online at kera.org.
Please call 800-456-5372. It's 1-800-456-KERA, or contribute online at kera.org. And please do it now. If you've considered a membership during the Think program, if you've thought about supporting the show in the last week or so during this membership campaign, please do it now so that we can meet this challenge. It's a $1,500 challenge from Fujitsu Network Communications. We've got to raise $5,000 during the show today in order to receive it. And I really want to be able to say we did it today. I want to thank Jan Doherty. Thank you so much, Jan and Dallas, for making an additional gift. We really appreciate your support. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to be able to thank you in the next couple of minutes. But it's only going to happen. We're only going to make this goal, Chris, if folks listening right now call 800-456-KERA.
We are so very close. You know, the show actually goes to the hour of 2:30. So that gives us about 2:15. You pick up the phone right now, and we will be in under the wire. So let's get there. We have, again, under $1,000 left to go in order to make this challenge. We receive, as a station, an additional $1,500. This, for us, is big money. And if your contribution of $100 or $500 or $75 or whatever it is gets us that much closer, you can consider that you were the one. Think of yourself as the one who made that $1,500 possible. Remember that you can become a Friends member at the $1,500 level with a contribution that only works out to $125 a month on a sustaining membership.
Yeah, the Friends are a group of folks here that join KERA and support the station at the level $1,500 or more a year. And that's just $125 a month if you do it on the sustaining membership program. And of course, a contribution at that level right now will help us make this goal for the show today, help us be able to receive this challenge from Fujitsu Network Communications. It's $1,500. It is at risk, and that's why it's crucial that you call now, 800-456-5372. Or if it's not convenient to make a phone call, please go online right now to KERA.org and contribute there.
If you wish we had talked again about a thank you gift that you've heard about in the past, they're pretty much all still available. So ask the volunteer about that, and we can hook you up with anything you've heard about throughout the drive. They're not time specific necessarily. We just ask that you pick up the phone now and call. We have under a minute to go for you to get through on the line. 1-800-456-5372 is the number. You can also go to KERA.org. We are getting closer, but we still have $850 left to go. That is, it's a challenge, but if you call right now, we can do this.
1-800-456-5372. Online at KERA.org. Again, we've got to raise $850 more dollars here in the next minute or so in order to be able to receive this additional $1,500 from Fujitsu Network Communications. Please don't wait. Please call right now.
You make it possible at 1-800-456-5372. Your online contributions count as well. Have $750 to go. Need to hear from you at KERA.org. Thanks.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.